Good afternoon. Today is Monday, the 8th of April, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. I'm joined by Mark Anderson. I'm joined by Professor Diane McCaddy. And I'm also joined by our outstanding guest, James Roguski, who will be giving us an update on what's happening with the WHO treaty. But we're going to get kicked off today with an update, a general look at what's happening in Ukraine, and we'll also touch on a little bit of what's been happening in Israel. But of course, Ukraine is a war zone, which is causing major pushback around the world. Let's have a little look at what Zelensky's been saying, because more or less he's taken as the spokesman for the whole event. And the headline here, which I've taken from the Kiev Post, is Ukraine to lose the war if UK Congress withholds aid. But if we think about it, this war's already been lost by Ukraine. It can only function due to the financial support and the munitions being put in by the US, the UK and the EU. And of course, all that is doing by dragging the war on is creating more and more casualties, particularly on the Ukrainian side, because they're taking heavier casualties. But also, of course, the Russians are suffering casualties as a result. So the war is over, or it would be if the West would stop pouring gasoline on the fire. Now, here's what Zelensky had to say. He said it's necessary to specifically tell Congress that if Congress does not help Ukraine, Ukraine will lose the war. And this, of course, is Zelensky getting very distressed because he knows that the vote for more money is not having an easy passage on the American side of the pond. And without that money, his war effort is simply going to collapse overnight. But of course, he also comes out with a warning. This is the scare tactics which Zelensky is constantly being used. If Ukraine loses the war, other states will be attacked. And it's quite remarkable, but it almost appears that in the US and in the UK and the EU within NATO, this is just being taken as an as-is, that if Ukraine falls, the Russians are going to sweep westward and conquer the rest of Western Europe. This is back to Cold War-type fear factor, and it's being ramped up particularly by the West and by NATO. Now, what is happening in the background? Well, we have senior retired military people who are simply telling us that we've got to now beef up Britain's military in particular in order to be able to take on the Russians. Let's just have a look at, let's have a little look at this short clip by General Barons.
We should all be concerned about NATO really for three reasons. The first is, it's absolutely clear now, and it's been developing since, in my view, 2014, when Russia invaded Crimea, that we, as part of NATO, are once again in a confrontation with Russia, which is really serious and might turn into conflict. And the most visible symptom of that, but not the only one, is the war in Ukraine. And we should be clear that as of today, that war is going in Russia's favor now.
Well, there was a key statement right at the end of that little clip that the war is going in Russia's favor. That is, Ukraine is losing this war. This is very clear. But what did the retired general go on to say? That UK needed to really beef up its military in order effectively to give Putin a beating. This, to me, is just extraordinary language, because in no way is the UK going to be capable of doing that, because it hasn't got the industrial base to support what he's claiming. And also the military are having huge difficulty recruiting the number of people, particularly into the army. But note he talks about confrontation turning into conflict. But the reality is that the military support from the UK, the US and other European countries is enabling Ukraine to keep fighting, and the munitions going in, munitions going in on the ground are also helping keep that that war running. Now, in the background, Ukraine has also been asking for more air defence systems. They want some 29 Patriot systems. This is because they've lost the existing systems that they've been given. They've been destroyed by the Russians. But what does this whole saga prove? That the Russians can target Ukrainian infrastructure at will. And the reality is that even if they were given more Western anti-air, anti-missile systems, they're not capable of stopping the Russian assault on their infrastructure. The other thing that's been happening, very rarely reported in UK or the West, is that the Ukrainians are clearly up to the old tricks of burying military equipment inside civilian areas. And the Russians have now been using long-range missile attacks to take out this sort of agenda. And the shot that we just had on screen was a destroyed shopping mall, which had been used for the storage of ammunition. And this image, which will just pop up on screen, is showing one of the HIMARS type rockets that's been thrown from the explosion as the Russians targeted that particular ammunition depot. But this is demonstrating the type of weapons that the Ukrainians have held in that type of environment. So within Donbass, this has been reported on many occasions that tanks and artillery have been hidden amongst civilian areas. But of course, in the Western media, this is a subject which is always pinned against the Russians. But the reality seems to be rather different. Now, the other thing that we know is that inside Ukraine, Zelensky and his generals are desperate for more manpower. This is due to the losses to date. And the tragedy is that they're going for ever younger, ever older people. And I chose this little video clip here because it's quite poignant when you look at the youth of the individuals concerned in this bus. This is where the Ukrainians have now got. So I can't call them boys, young men, but also women are being drawn into this proxy war. And of course, this is not going to do the Ukraine any good, or it's not going to keep Ukraine operating as a nation state. It is destroying the future of Ukraine for the proxy war, which the US and the UK are so keen to wage in order to try and drive regime change in Russia. Now, if we have a look at some of the reporting from within Ukraine, the Kiev Post here, Ukraine's global voice, it calls itself. I've marked with a red arrow that we've got, we'll just move that a little bit quickly, but the blue box is showing the Ministry of Defence reports from UK. This is their Twitter. And my point here is that it's alongside completely different opinion. And we're going to have a look at some of this opinion and try and explain what's happening. But here is the article, the unseen, if we can just, okay. Sorry, we've switched slides a bit quickly here. Here's the unseen crisis, Russian soldiers' desperation on the Ukrainian front lines. And basically, in this article, which has no evidence shown to the reader at all, Russian soldiers are holding grenades to their heads, and if they think they're going to be hit by a Ukrainian drone strike, they're apparently going to kill themselves using that those grenades. Now, this is the story that's been put forward by this gentleman, Casey Christie, but no actual evidence. He just says that he's been watching a lot of videos from the battlefield, and this is his opinion. But a very interesting gentleman, because if we look at the next article that he's got, he's talking about this. It's time for an African solution to Russian mercenaries in Africa. And what the article talks about is Ukrainian mercenaries actually standing up against the Wagner forces in the Russian forces in Africa. And he says the Ukrainians should be commended for recognizing the importance of countering Russia in Africa, a position that seems to be uniquely theirs. So what's the solution? So his solution is this: while the Expeditionary Corps entices with the illusory promise of quick fixes or sales pitches touting regime survival packages, a far more sustainable and legitimate approach lies in the establishment of an African private military company. So it's quite remarkable that this man is clearly what advertising for mercenaries in order to get Ukrainians to join up in order to go and join a private military company in Africa. This sounds like deep state spook work, but it's very difficult to get a grip of this man, because who is he exactly? If we have a look at what he says in the article, it's this: having spent the first 25 years of my life in Africa, dedicating over 4,000 hours to protecting and serving on the streets of Johannesburg as an unpaid police officer, and having invested significantly in writing about the continent's criminals, terrorists and pirates, my convictions are firmly rooted. So what is the solution? And if we go on through, experience, he says, has reinforced a belief that crystallized over a decade ago during a, quote, security conference in Portsmouth, England. There, the pressing issue was how to address Somali pirates off the Horn of Africa who were hijacking entire ships and securing millions of dollars in ransom. So this man appears to be a unpaid police officer for the bulk of his career, but he's having meetings discussing piracy in UK. And at the time those meetings were taking place, the UK column was informed that that was absolutely British Ministry of Defence. They were there in the background, so were British Special Forces, and so were some mercenaries. Now, that is what we were told. That's an allegation. But interesting that he's recounting that type of meeting in Portsmouth as triggering his present comments. And if we follow through on this, gentlemen, we quickly have this report: Mark on World, urgent advisory for close protection services. And if we have a look at who's initiated that, Christie and Associates. And if we bring on the next part of it, this appears to be the gentleman's own website. And this is all about protection and private military services. So the point that we're making here is who exactly is ramping up the angst in Ukraine? And is it really the case that the agenda is to get more Ukrainians to fight another proxy war by joining private military corporations, companies in Africa? I'll leave our audience to think about that, but clearly we're seeing that events in Ukraine are not as simple as perhaps the BBC would have us think, that it's just that the Ukrainians have been attacked by those nasty Russians and they are busy trying to defend their country. There is something else at work. And if we move across to Israel, this was from a few days ago, but the Washington Post here with a headline: US signs off on more bombs, warplanes for Israel. Despite a widening rift with the Israeli government, the Biden administration continues to authorize the transfer of 2,000-pound bombs and other weapons. This, of course, is widely known, but the Americans are continuing to put in the weapons into Israel, even though at the moment there appears to be some disagreement between the US and Israel as a result of the attacks on the aid workers. What isn't being widely reported is the scale of unrest inside Israel itself. And we've had massive protests taking place in Israel. The crowds seem to be unfazed by the idea that they would be a target for the Iranians. Let's just have a look at this little film clip and see what's being said about those demonstrations.
Yeah!
So a large demonstration, clearly some violence. The crowd, what were the crowd after? They wanted the hostages returned, which is completely understandable. But they were also protesting about the conduct of the war by Netanyahu. And many of them were calling for him to step down. So protest in Israel at what has happened following those Gaza attacks. Now, let's have a look at this clip from David Cameron, who of course is supposed to be doing good ambassadorial work in order to calm things down and obtain peace. Let's hear what he had to say.
On October the 7th, Hamas carried out the deadliest attack on the Jewish people since the Holocaust. 183 days later, Hamas still holds over 100 hostages. Today, our appeal is as strong as on the day they were taken. Hamas must release them, every one of them, right now. We know little about the conditions of their captivity. We cannot even be sure who is still alive. But we know who they are. Two British nationals and the citizens of many other nations. Students and festival goers, construction workers and a historian of the Holocaust. Parents, children, loved ones. The Prime Minister and I have met the family members of many hostages. They are showing incredible courage in the most unimaginably difficult circumstances. It is utterly inhumane to extend their agony. And so today, 6 months on from October the 7th, we renew our solidarity with the victims. We stand with the families. We condemn the terrorists, and we call again, send the hostages home.
I always have great difficulty looking at David Cameron speaking in his very measured way, where he's being sincere in an insincere way. But the point I really want our audience to think about is that way back in 2011 and onwards, David Cameron was expressing his unbreakable support for Israel. So when we see David Cameron talking about Israel, who is he actually talking for? Who does he represent? Does he represent the people of UK, or is his priority the people of Israel? And our point is, we don't mind. We just like him to be honest about which side it really is, because no man can have two masters. And we covered this issue in the UK column article at the time, and encouraged people to have a read and see why we believe that this is an impossible situation, that we have such a powerful Israeli lobby within UK changing agenda as we have a major conflict in Gaza. Well, let's move on from that and bring in our guest, James Roguski. And I'm just going to say to the audience, just prior to the news, we were having a little chat. And I said, the trouble is, James, we haven't got much good news. But you said to me instantly, I've got some good news. So welcome to UK Column. What have you got for us?
Well, you know, I have way too much information for the time that we have. So if you would be kind enough to give me notice halfway through, what I want to do is partition what we talk about between the two instruments that are being negotiated, the treaty and the amendments. So I'll start off with what most people call the pandemic treaty. They had in their negotiations what was supposed to be their last 2 weeks of negotiations at the end of the last month, and they failed to reach an agreement. So they've had to schedule more meetings from April 29th to May the 10th. About a year ago, I published an article about our ambassador, Hamamoto, agreeing with the Chinese delegate that they wanted to keep all of the details of which nation made what proposal secret from everyone in the public. Well, I published a leaked document, right? I should say I republished a leaked document. It was first published by KEI Online and Politico, which is a 110-page document that details what each nation has suggested as text edits to what they did in their last negotiations. Is they had a 29-page document They were hoping to end the negotiations after 2 weeks, but instead, the nations made over 5,000 text edits, and the document ballooned from 29 up to 110 pages. They're having a little bit of difficulty reaching agreement, and I want people to understand that the treaty is really not what most people think it is. In my view, it's a trade agreement that has gone, you know, really in the wrong direction. They want to invest billions of dollars to go looking for pathogens with pandemic potential so they can bring them into a WHO coordinated laboratory network, hand them over with the contract so that the pathogen access that would then proliferate, you know, these dangerous pathogens all around the world with all the different laboratories, would only be given in return for benefit sharing, the pathogen access benefit sharing system. This is a money-making venture that would end up resulting in speeded up regulatory approval by the WHO to determine whether or not jabs and tests and things are, you know, acceptable. And then the WHO would be in charge of a distribution and logistics network. This is a business deal that I feel is akin to any kind of, you know, corrupt cartel. I've dubbed it the new OPEC. OPEC is the oil producing and exporting countries. But this is really the organization of pandemic emergency corporations. What they're doing is trying to build out the fear-mongering mechanisms, the infrastructure, so that they can always be telling people, there's an emergency, there's an emergency. And so it's the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office, your good friend, David Cameron, who is really in charge of this, because what this really is taking billions of dollars from the wealthier nations of the global north to invest in the pharmaceutical hospital emergency industrial complex in the global south so that they can distribute the manufacturing geographically, and oligarchs in poor nations can turn a profit by scaring the daylights out of people in their nations, because there's a lot of black and brown people that they didn't jab the first time around. Now, that's a summary of what's going on with the treaty.
That's excellent.
And I'll keep going.
I'll just give you the introduction to do it. So that's what they're up to, but you're finding that they're not meeting all their timescales, and you've now been able to look at information which they prefer to have hidden. Is that correct?
That's correct. Everyone can view that information at stopthetreaty.org. And if you like, I'll keep going with the other negotiations, the amendments. 4 weeks ago, actually a little bit more than that, I obtained a similar document for what is being negotiated with the amendments. Now, for me, that was kind of like the Holy Grail. I was actually looking for a new version of the treaty, and I stumbled upon this document on one of the Geneva organizations that's, you know, part of the inner circle. They get access to the things that we're not allowed to see. And so you can find that document on rejecttheamendments.com. So the first one was stopthetreaty.org. This is rejecttheamendments.com. And again, what's in the document is dramatically different than what was presented originally a year ago. And I want everyone to understand, all of the information that we've ever been allowed to see is a year old. And so after a year's worth of negotiations, I got lucky and I found the February 9th negotiating text. Now, I know we don't have time to really get into this discussion, but the difference in terminology between the word isolation and quarantine, the common language understanding of those words, if you read the 2005 definition of those words, it's exactly the opposite of what most people think. Isolation is what most people think. Well, I'm going to go hide in my room somewhere. And quarantine, most people think, well, you know, if someone's sick, they put them in quarantine. But the legal definition in the 2005 IHR is exactly the opposite. And so what they have added quietly, that's not in the original documents, is they want to add strengthening language to enable nations to quarantine international travelers as appropriate. Now, I think the terms as appropriate are a little too vague for my liking, but even with that, what would they be using as a criteria to determine whether or not an entire vessel, they call it a conveyance, a cruise ship, an airplane, you know, a train, a bus, you know, any kind of vehicle. Isolation in their language is what they do to people who are ill. Quarantine is what they seek to be able to do to people who maybe have passed by or on the same ship with someone who is ill. It is an exponential strengthening. And this is where everybody gets it backwards. That is not an attack on national sovereignty. That is a ridiculous strengthening of national sovereignty that would enable each nation to abuse the rights and freedoms of foreign travelers. So if you want to go on holiday, you take a cruise or a flight or whatever, and for some appropriate reason, as determined by the officials in the foreign country where you may be landing, this is a gentleman's international agreement where all of the nations, it's not coming from the WHO. It's not that the WHO is saying they have to do anything. The doublespeak is amazing. The IHR says, no, don't do that unless you want to. I mean, you have to read it to actually believe it. And so the concern about adding in the ability to quarantine, and now quarantine doesn't mean you're sick. Quarantine means somebody said, you know, we're going to lock up this airplane or boat or whatever it may be. This is very disturbing. It was not in the original documents. It is in the documents that were leaked. And I encourage everyone to go to the websites that I mentioned, or you can just go to jamesroguski.substack.com or call me at 310-619-3055. I'm in the U.S. You can text me or use any of the apps. That is absolutely unacceptable, to give government more power to just lock people up as they deem appropriate.
Yeah, so James, it's fear, first of all, followed by more power. But you did mention that they'd also had comments in from countries which clearly had embarrassed them, and they didn't want to make that available very quickly. You've been able to see some of those comments, is that correct?
In the document of, you know, for the treaty on stopthetreaty.org and the document for the amendments, rejecttheamendments.com, you can just download and type in UK if you want to search to see all of the text edits that were submitted to either remove or add language. And, you know, any nation, they have abbreviations for each nation. I published an article a couple of days ago for the United States, who had submitted 500 and some proposed text amendments. I think the UK had 200 and some or thereabouts. So you can see what they don't want you to see, what they have been submitting as text languages from the United States, and I believe it's similar for the UK and the EU. Very, very, very much of it is in support of protections for the pharmaceutical companies, you know, just basically, in short, to protect their profits. In these negotiations, it's not about health for the people. This is a transfer of wealth, you know, from poor people in rich nations to rich people in poor nations.
James, thank you very much. Well, let's bring Mark Anderson in here, because Mark's got a segment on the WHO. So, Mark, welcome to UK Column News. Fascinating update from James there. What's your thoughts?
I say maybe Jim could share some contact info with the Office of Global Affairs of DHHS, and I'll have some contact info for the U.S. Senate, et cetera, coming up here momentarily. But as a registered reporter with the WHO's press conferences, I've been following what Tedros in particular has been saying. I covered a March 21 press conference that I reported last time I was on here 2 weeks ago. Well, March 25th, the Director General of the WHO, Tedros, addressed the inter Parliamentary Union, a rather obscure organization founded in 1889. And I would note that inter-parliamentary, of course, the prefix inter means between or among. So he's trying to insinuate himself among national parliaments that are members of the IPU. So it's very strategic and tactical what he's doing. And here's some of what he had to say to the IPU March 25th. On this one, he said, "We cannot forget the painful lessons the pandemic taught us and the scars it left. More than 7 million people lost their lives to COVID-19, allegedly. And those are just the reported deaths. We know the true number is much higher. The pandemic also caused, as you know, significant social, economic, and political upheaval." Of course, so much with many power brokers, Tedros included, is in what they don't say. He doesn't mention, he never mentions any hint that the jabs, the injections, the mRNA injections could have caused any harm or illness or deaths. That is completely off the page. It's never spoken of. So that's cause for alarm right there. The hubris or the misdirection there, that only COVID-19 brought about deaths and the jabs could not possibly have had anything to do with that. And then he goes on to say on that same slide, "The key issue now is whether we will learn the lessons the pandemic has taught us so we don't repeat them the next time." Again, notice the irony in what he's saying. The lessons of the pandemic included, of course, the dangers of these injections, and that's still being largely covered up. And of course, he always says this, "And there will be a next time. The next pandemic is a matter of when, not if." So very interesting there. Moving on from there, he had this to say, "The pandemic agreement aims to address the gaps and challenges all countries face and to ensure we're better prepared for future pandemics." Of course, the new agreement would be an instrument of international law, similar to the many other accords and treaties the nations have agreed, the Geneva Conventions, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the Paris Agreement on climate change, and so on. The mention of the Paris Agreement is rather interesting. However, there are two major obstacles. He mentioned this at the press conference and to the IPU. Obstacles to meeting that deadline of approving the pandemic agreement. The first, he says, is the group of issues on which countries have not reached consensus. James just alluded to that. There's been some snags and some delays, and that buys time for, of course, those that are very skeptical of this treaty and the IHR. And then this, he went on to say this, "The second major barrier is the litany of lies and conspiracy theories about the agreement, that it's a power grab by the WHO that will cede national sovereignty to WHO and give it the power to impose lockdowns or vaccine mandates on countries." Unfortunately, he added, some of these lies have been spread even by members of parliament and in some cases heads of governments. Let me be clear, these claims are completely and categorically false. The agreement is being written by countries for countries and will be implemented by countries in accordance with their own national laws. And moving on from there, he even goes on to say, in fact, it says the exact opposite. Let me read you Article 24, Paragraph 3 of the negotiating text of the pandemic agreement. And it shows that quote from the text. I'm not sure if that's exactly how it is right now, but it says, "Nothing in the WHO pandemic agreement shall be interpreted as providing the WHO secretariat, including the WHO DG, any authority to direct, order, alter, or otherwise prescribe the domestic laws or policies of any party, or to mandate or otherwise impose any requirements that parties take specific actions, such as a ban or acceptance of travelers, imposing vaccination mandates or therapeutic or diagnostic measures, or implement lockdowns." Now, of course, you have to look at the supranational framework that the UN fits into. And then the WHO, of course, is a child of the UN system. All supranational arrangements are a threat to sovereignty, one degree or another, one way or another. A lot of this is very disingenuous. The way that this would work would be like any UN covenant that we've seen, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, where human rights are recognized unless they go against the grain of the principles of the United Nations. There's always those sort of exceptions. And you'll notice here, this is the next statement in this slide, right after he quoted that treaty section. He says, "We urge parliaments to be aware of these issues and to support the ongoing negotiations. The pandemic agreement, listen to this closely, is the cornerstone of a new, stronger architecture for global health security that the WHO and member states are building. This includes key actions for stronger governance, stronger financing, stronger systems and tools, and a stronger WHO. So the WHO is seen as gaining power from this. So this is very typical of the shifty language you find that is replete in UN covenants and even in the UN Charter itself. And if you think about the International Organization for Migration, which I cited recently on WHO, and also a UN report going back to the year 2000, we found quite recently that those documents are instrumental in the migration invasion at the US southern border, and that the presence of UN personnel and UN documents was found along the route going all the way from Ecuador up to the southern border. So the UN is notoriously found to be involved in actions that tend to diminish U.S. sovereignty, and the southern border is a great example of that. Another was the Korean War, the first UN war that was fought from 1950 to 1953. And since then, the U.S. has not declared through Congress wars at all. And by the time we got to Desert Storm and Desert Shield, the U.N. Security Council was pretty much in charge of the coalition against Iraq and the movement of military forces. So a lot of sovereignty was lost there as well within the UN system. And this last slide, or among the last slides anyway, is something that some people find ineffectual and maybe just symbolic, but it's just something I discovered in listening to some other videos on this matter. Louisiana is balking at the WHO, the UN, and the World Economic Forum, saying that those organizations don't have that the state of Louisiana's, those organizations don't have any jurisdiction over the state of Louisiana and things like that. And supposedly the state of Tennessee is doing the same thing, Brian. There's a lot to unpack here, but these are just some of the latest developments. People can go to, as this next slide shows, you can go to the parliament.uk website to contact the House of Lords and House of Commons to share your concerns about the treaty and the regs. Of course, Jim's got a more direct route through the DHHS. And then here you've got the U.S. Senate. The main number is 202-224-3121. You can ask for any senator by name. But the main thing here is Senate Bill 444 by Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. That bill has been dormant, strangely, for over a year. And it called for recognizing the WHO Pandemic Accord as a treaty. And then the Senate would exercise its constitutional duties to have its advice and consent on that treaty. And that's a very important act of sovereignty to play out or to apply that constitutional principle. And I also included here, and people can see this in the slides later, how to contact members of the EU Parliament, as well as, I said, the UK Parliament and the US Senate. So that's pretty much what I have for now, Brian, in the time provided.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much for that excellent run through. James, we're running over at the moment, but just 20 seconds. Is there anything that you'd like to specifically comment on that Mark's covered there?
The local tyrants that abused your rights over the last 4.5 years didn't need any amendments or didn't need any treaty to do what they did over the last 4.5 years. So the core battle is still local. You know, whatever they did to you in the past, they did by confusion and such. The amendments, you have to be concerned about expanded quarantine of international travelers. And the treaty is a trade deal to take money away from your country to give to oligarchs in poor nations so that they can make more biological weapons to jab the people they missed the first time around.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's going to prevent the next pandemic. They're going to try to profit from it.
Okay, thank you very much, James Rogowski. Let's move on to the subject of the abuse of children. I'll put a comment here that if we have governments that can't protect our own children, those governments are capable of doing anything anywhere in the world. That's my personal opinion. Let's bring on Professor Diane Rasmussen-McCaddy. Diane, pleasure to have you back with us, and you've got an update on the Fenethi women for us.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, it's great to be here with you today. So just as a reminder for anyone who may not have been following the Fenethi case since UK Column started covering it early last year, they're a group of women who were abused in care, in residential school care, from around 1960 to 1991. There is an ongoing petition that's very active, lots going on. So just as a bit of an update, let's play this short video from STV News, which captures some highlights from the petitions committee meeting in March.
Why are you guys here today? You have obviously been campaigning for justice for a while. So what is it that brings you to Holyrood today?
We just want to be heard. Again and again, we've been here before and we'll keep coming until they hear us and take some action. So the more politicians we can get on board, the stronger our case is. So that's really why we're here, to be heard and seen. And we will not go away.
So that is actually a clip from the podcast that the four of the leaders of the Fenethi group did on the day of the petitions committee meeting. They were obviously very angry. And as they said, they really just want to be seen and heard. The petition is for the purpose of being able to apply for the redress scheme with the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry, which to date has spent over £72 million, mostly, I think, on legal fees to protect the Scottish government. So here we have the official report, which is available. The link will be in the show notes covering the transcript of that meeting. And you can also see here, just out of interest, as a side note, that two of the other petitions under consideration is one on thrombosis and one on sudden cardiac death. So referring back to James's and Mark's segments, I wonder why that might be. After this, we have had a lot of media participation immediately following the petitions committee meeting. So in addition to this transcript, as you'll see here on the next slide, we've got a couple of just screenshots of some issues around what we keep being called Fenethi House instead of Fenethi Residential School. The issue here is that it was never called Fenethi House when the women were there in attendance. It was always called Fenethi Residential School from the time that it was from a residential school to the end. And we also see a lot of inaccuracies around reporting why the women were there, were sent there. They were there because of, for different reasons. We have a lot of different reasons why we think it happened, but the inaccuracies reported in the media committee meeting was that it's for convalescent care or respite care or holiday camp. Was actually none of those at all whatsoever. There are different reasons why women were sent there. So what we've been trying to do is work to correct the messages that get sent out. And some of these media outlets have corrected their coverage immediately when we've asked them to do so. And it's saying, please don't call it Fenethi House anymore. Please don't say it was for convalescent care. Let's just say what it was a residential school where the teachers were there and the children were in charge of people by the state when they were there, which is what Scottish law calls for. So next we'll see an example of this here. If we can go to the next slide, we see here that we've had some changes from removing Fenethi House to Fenethi Residential School and saying they were from disadvantaged backgrounds, which tends to be the closest to what we seem to be able to say that it is. Definitely not convalescent, definitely not respite, and definitely not a holiday home. They were there for 6 weeks of horrific abuse.
So, Diane, if I can just come on, we just need to move on to the next slide because this is the key issue here that the government has been trying to call Fenethi something which it is not. So, just give us this one again while we've got the screen on, the slide on screen.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, so this was from Glasgow Live, which was they very quickly corrected it. So we will see here, it doesn't say Fenethi House, it doesn't say Fenethi Residential School. The problem here, as we have been able to isolate, is Shona Robinson and the SNP, and I would imagine Hamza Yusuf as well, because they keep saying, well, the abuse was only short term. So they were only there for 4 to 6 weeks at a time. So therefore, they don't qualify to apply for the redress scheme because, you know, what is 6 weeks of abuse, right? And it's absolutely, absolutely despicable. So again, here we see the corrections that have been made for Fenethi Residential School and girls from disadvantaged backgrounds. rather than Fenethi House, convalescent. And those are the messages that the government has been pushing, which has not been helpful at all for the case. If we can go to the next slide. So this is my article that was published on UK Column a few weeks ago, which goes into the detail that I found when I visited the archives for several months from last autumn going into the first part of this year, as well as if you look at the UK Column news from 2 weeks ago, I've got the coverage on there. What we're seeing now, because there's been a press release by the Fenethi ladies that UK Column has assisted with, we're seeing Yahoo News here as an example of an aggregator that is sort of resharing these older articles from a few weeks ago. And I just happened to see these over the weekend. There's one from February when we had a Fenethi conference where we shared some of these findings of what I found in the archives, as well as issues around human rights and the legal case that is undergoing, as well as the protests from November. That was when we were at George Square protesting outside of Glasgow City Chambers. And that's me in the yellow raincoat looking like, as my husband called it, a waterproof banana. But I did not provide that. That was from the one of the ladies. So if we go on next here to the next slide. This was from the Sunday Mail from last Sunday. So it's the biggest newspaper in Scotland. We had a full page of coverage about what was going on with the case. Most of this article was directly quoted from the press release that the ladies put out. So we sent it out to multiple media sources. And this next piece here is from Brian Whittall, who's one of the MSPs who is in support of the women, has been from the very beginning, along with some of the other MSPs. So we can see here that his officially submitted evidence in support of the petition says that that the education bill and a lot of legislation before this throughout Scotland, in the acts before this, as well as when the women were sent there, is that they do act in loco parentis in place of the parent, which basically means that anything that happens to the children when they are in school is the responsibility of the state, the teachers, the staff, whoever was there. And so therefore, Brian Whittall's conclusion is that because of this, they are potentially, the government's potentially violating the laws from the UN Convention of the Rights of Children by excluding abuse victims because they were abused just the same as anyone in long-term care or any other sort of school situation. Just because they were in short-term care doesn't necessarily mean that they should be excluded. Actually, they shouldn't be. So we have some activity going on social media. If you want to follow our Twitter account, we are at Fenethi Ladies on Twitter/X. So we've been reposting a lot of the media and trying to target some activity towards Hamza Yousaf and Shona Robinson. Brian has done an excellent job of contacting Shona Robinson and the SNP and Hamza Yousaf through several tweets as well. And as you can see there, he's retweeted some of these articles. And this one post, for example, has had over 4,500 views on as of when I took the screenshot. So we're getting a lot of good coverage there as well. If you want to get involved, and I hope people can, if you are in Scotland or can get to Scotland, we will have the next Petitions Committee meeting on the 17th of April. At 9:30 a.m. here in Edinburgh at Holyrood. We are planning a large protest, and you can also sign this petition here to allow them to access the redress scheme, which is directly through the Scottish Parliament, Scottish Government website. And we have a change.org petition as well that you can sign. That one also has, well, we've already met our goal of 500 signatures, but we want more, obviously. And we have just started a crowdfund that will go directly to the ladies that they can use for cost of transportation and so on. So please donate if you can. Thanks.
Okay, Diane, thank you very much for that update. It's good to see that things are starting to move, and it's particularly good to see that some of the members of the Scottish Parliament getting properly involved there, including the gentleman you mentioned, who's also pointed out he thinks that a lot of the stalling is due to the fact that the government's getting worried about how much money it would have to pay out in compensation to the ladies. But more on that in due course. Now, if people like what the UK column is doing, then we're going to say, please support us. Please become a paid up subscriber, because we can only do what we do with your financial support. You are very much the UK column and we need your help. You can help us, of course, by making a purchase through the UK column shop, and get online and have a look at that. And please do share our information, because that's the reason that we do what we do, to inform people and to pass out information. Remember to mention us if you do that, though. Thank you very much. Now, we also want to say we've got this important film coming out, Playing God. This is as a result of the excellent work, an investigation into medical democide in the UK. This is the journalist Jackie Devoy and her team, and it's going to be premiered by the UK column at 2 p.m. Monday, the 22nd of April, and you'll be able to see that through ukcolumn.org live. So very, very powerful piece of work, and I think it's going to make a big difference. We've also got tomorrow the Part 4 of The Green King. This is Debbie Evans and myself talking about what King Charles III is really up to. Encourage you to have a look at that at 1 o'clock. We've had many emails from people thanking us for this and telling us that it's really changed the whole way that they're thinking about the royal family and King Charles himself. So do join us. We've got an advert here for an event, Society Controlled or Free. This is Thursday the 11th, 4:45 to 9:30 p.m. at the Emmanuel Centre, which is 9 to 23 Marsham Street in London. Tickets, the early bird tickets, that is until today, is £20, and then it's £25, and you can book via Eventbrite. Okay, thank you very much for that. And as I say, if you are not a full supporter of UK Column, perhaps you consider doing that, because it's really our members that keep us going. Mark, let's bring you back in, because you are here to report a bit more on the Council of Foreign Relations and what they've been updating.
Yeah, this is, of course, the former Chicago CFR. It's now called the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And there's a couple things upcoming that I'll be covering virtually in real time, as I've been doing with the WHO press conferences, to keep the firsthand news flowing for UK Column as a general assignment reporter. This one is coming up tomorrow, World Health Day, and they're combining migration, climate change, and global health. What global health might have to do directly with the treaty and all that, I'm not sure, but it's an interesting illustration that goes along with the advertisement for this upcoming program, a needle going into the entire globe. Rather interesting right there. And there's one other one. Well, this is a little bit more about the first one, excuse me. I'll just briefly mention that Ibrahim Abubakar, boy, I hope I don't butcher that, he is with the University College London. He's the provost there, and he has a guest, Maya Prabhu, who's a clinical associate professor of law, Yale Law School. They'll be discussing that program, and I'll be covering that tomorrow and reporting on that next week. It says here, just to describe it briefly, a critical nexus exists between migration, climate change, and global health. Escalating conflicts and climate crises have caused displacement to become a harsh reality for millions, exacerbating global health challenges. The only thing I'll mention there, of course, is that it's interesting that the Biden administration wants a completely open border and did everything it could to get rid of Title 42, while at the same time claiming that COVID is a great viral threat. How you square that with a totally open border policy is beyond me. Anyway, the other program is going to be the 24th of April. This is an interesting one. New Cold Wars, a conversation with David Sanger. He's with the New York Times. This will get a lot into Russia, China, and probably Ukrainian matters, Brian, and I'll be covering that as well. I think there's a little something about David Sanger. He, of course, is with the Times, White House, and National Security Correspondent. And his name has also popped up at Bilderberg on occasion. So we'll see what they have to say and be reporting later, Brian.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Yes, what are they up to? It's difficult to tell, isn't it? Now, I think this brings us back onto the subject of education. And Diane, you're going to tell us what's been happening. Big protest in Holyrood up in Scotland. What's actually been happening? Have we lost you on sound? Yeah. Or have we lost you altogether? Are you there, Diane? I still can't hear you. We're having a few little issues today.
Hello.
Yes, you're here. Well done.
Okay. Sorry about that. Must have been a blip in the internet. So that is actually that's the slide for the protest at Holyrood. We had a lot of protests going on over here in Edinburgh on Saturday, actually. So for those of you who follow Posy Parker, or Kelly J. Keene is her real name, who speaks for Let Women Speak, we had a Let Women Speak Edinburgh event. And the whole point was for women to be able to come and speak, right? So as we should be able to do. And what actually happened was a lot of the coverage that we saw on Twitter was some of the peaceful part of the women just coming and sharing their thoughts on being an actual woman. Some of it, unfortunately, got really violent, which I think is unfortunate considering what's going on with the hate speech situation here in Scotland with the big crime bill that came in the hate crime bill that came in on April Fool's Day. So here's one example of the trans activists saying, "You better use my pronouns, darling, or I'm going to have to make your pronouns was were." Now, that's a death threat. Why that is not hate speech, I don't understand. We have some other ones as well. That you can go on and look at Twitter. If you look at hashtag Let Women Speak Edinburgh, there's a whole bunch of them, some videos that you can look at. But this leads me to what is actually hate speech and what is actually hateful speech. And as someone that comes into the UK column as a librarian, as an academic, one thing that I'm concerned about is why are we giving UK degrees to students who are from other countries who are not necessarily qualified to study in an English-speaking country? And this was an article from last week from the Times Higher Education, which covers this very issue around what's going on, why it's difficult for us as staff, that basically we're doing this for the benefit of the universities to bring in as much money as possible because overseas students pay more money to be at university. And he goes on in this article to say, in the West, we talk about decolonizing the curriculum, but we invariably regard our educative model as superior when we export it to new overseas ventures, meaning that the students that we bring in from other parts of the world are very different from here, and we don't necessarily work as much as we could to make them feel like they are able to complete courses well in the UK. And he calls us colonizers. We force students who come to the UK at their own will to spend their own money as colonizers. So we are now colonizing these students coming here who want one of the best educations that they can get. And we force them and the students and apparently the academics that we hire from other countries to teach and learn in English, inviting miscommunication. Now, in my opinion, they're here because we have a great reputation in the UK and the US for having amazing education opportunities. So I am a member of the editorial team of the Scottish Union for Education, and you can read my full article on decolonization if you go back to our newsletter from January. And a lot of people want to know, what is decolonization? What exactly does that mean? So it operates on the belief that everyone who was not white is disadvantaged because they are not white, imitating Hamza Yusuf, white. That white people violently colonize non-white societies and force them to become westernized, and that white people, the colonizers, are the oppressors or the settlers, and non-white people are the oppressed. So, going on from there, the former British Empire is presented as a prime example of colonization. Some left-leaning academics, myself not included, believe that white people must acknowledge their white guilt and compensate non-whites for their white privilege by decolonizing. Decolonization does not involve other characteristics that some academics identify as marginalized, such as gender, sexuality, socioeconomic status, or disability, only whiteness. So where do we go from there? So here's a short video from the UK the Students Union for Education talking about decolonization. And I apologize in advance. I should have a trigger warning on this video, but please go ahead.
Hi, what are you looking for? I'm looking for a library that teaches me about decolonization, gives me resources to learn, and connects me with other keen campaigners. You may not find that here, but I know a place. Was that the library you're looking for? Oh my god, yes! Let's decolonize education.
So that is just the best resource ever, Ryan. So here, if we go to the next page here, this is what is now the NUS Liberation Library. And you can see here that we have, as we do in this type of environment, different categories of people, because we like to categorize people by labels. So we have Black resources, trans resources, LGBT plus, and at the very bottom of the pyramid, disabled and women. And here we see here Sarah Khan again, who we just saw in that brilliant TikTok video. If anybody knows what this means, please let me know, because I have studied decolonization. I still don't know what this means. Divestment campaigns are a way of showing our institutions that we are not fooled by their co-option of the term decolonize. We say no to their material complicity in colonial violence. So if you read James Lindsay's work on new discourses, he talks about decolonization being violent. But let's look at what decolonization means to professional librarians. This is from the University of Liverpool Libraries.
However, historical material contains language and illustrative depictions of people that are offensive and outdated. These instances may be racist, homophobic, sexist, or ableist, and more broadly, a significant part of the systematic marginalisation of people throughout history. Therefore, the archivists at the University of Liverpool are currently working to identify offensive or outdated language that is used within the metadata on the dedicated archives catalogue.
So that was from a 1 hour long webinar on the issue of how to decolonize the library catalogue at the University of Liverpool. So here is the example that she follows that with. We have an article or an item called Chinese paintings from the archives. The original term was costumes, male and female Chinese costumes. So that was offensive. So we changed it to, big reveal here, traditional dress, which is less offensive or not offensive compared to the word costumes. And we include a note at the bottom explaining that it has been edited to remove historic information and or terminology that is offensive and or outdated. So that is what's being considered offensive or non-offensive under the rules of decolonization in universities. However, and also in the library profession, we have the Rainbow Book List, which is not offensive. In fact, it is highly promoted. This is from the American Library Association's Rainbow LGBT Club. And the Rainbow Book List is something that they produce every year. One of the numbers from 2024, the top 10 for young readers, is a picture book. So it's meant for children before primary school, called Granddad's Pride. Granddad's Pride is created by an author called Harry Woodburn, who is, of course, a they-them. And we see here, they go to a pride festival and we see two men kissing, one of them wearing leather bondage gear. So this is what librarians are using as an argument against censorship. Oh, we can't be censoring what people read, but at the same time, we're censoring the word costume and replacing it with traditional dress to avoid being offensive. So in my opinion, Brian, on behalf of my entire profession, I apologize.
Well, Diane, you didn't do that because you're doing a sterling job trying to expose what's actually happening. But if we sum up what we've had in our news today, of course, we've got the immense fear that the conflict in Ukraine and also in Israel-Gaza is causing in many people. We've got dictatorial bodies such as the World Health Organization telling us how they're going to take control in a pandemic. And if somebody thinks that they're going to be standing up to speak out about what's going to happen, well, they're going to change your language so that you can't, or in fact, via the Online Harms Bill, we're going to be saying, no, you can't speak out because that's an attack on another person. So it's pretty obvious what's going on. It's got different facets, but of course, what is the best way to start to deal with what's happening? It's to expose it and talk about it. We're going to have to end the news there. We did have some other material, but I'm going to keep that for another day. And I'd just like to thank James Rogowski very much coming onto the news today to give us an update. I'm not sure whether you can join us for extra. If you can, James, that would be very welcome. So we'll end the news there. Thank you all for joining us wherever you are in the world. And if you're a member of UK Column, we'll have extra for you in a few minutes. Thank you. Bye-bye.